Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me tonight, as always, is my co-host,
Chad Mintz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. So, Chad, 40 years, we have lived in a world where a galaxy far, far away has captivated our imagination. Your thoughts, sir, on the fact that Star Wars, had its 40th anniversary of A New Hope?
It's been 40 years. It's something that most people have grown up with. It just doesn't seem like it's been 40 years. And here we are, New Hope Day. We've got episode 8 coming out this year, and it seems like the Star Wars train is just going to keep rolling. It's just amazing what's happened in 40 years, and it's only been, like, officially, 9 movies on the books right now? Well, really 8. We haven't got the 9th one yet. Mm-hmm. We've got so much other stuff.
Well, you had a lot of empty territory to play with, because there's a large gap between 6 and 3. Mm-hmm. 6 and 1. And there's a large gap between 3 and 7. So, I mean, there was time where you had to fill in with TV series and cartoon series and books and, comic books and novels and, fan sites and fan films and all kinds of various things.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the fun of Star Wars. We have these movies that everybody loves and goes out to see. But really, it's all like the other filling stuff that's come up that's like really driven us to becoming the monster that it is. It's just weird to think about. It's been around 40 years. We only have these 8 movies, but yet there's not a person on the planet that doesn't know what Star Wars is.
Do you know what's been around for 20 years now?
What is this, 20? So that would be 1997? Mm-hmm. No.
That would be the special editions of the Star Wars trilogy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
An entire generation of children only know
the special edition
that Han shot first.
The first one has got a whole lot of fancy stuff. I mean, the first set I ever owned was when the special editions came out. It's when that came out that I really got on the Star Wars train. So I don't hate them like other people do. Looking at them now, I'm still like, okay, you didn't need to really do all this stuff, George. But I will still say that of the three, Empire is the one that probably still stands up the best.
There's not much. I mean, the biggest complaints really are threefold. One is the Mos Eisley sequence, where he just adds a bunch of stuff into the frame of every shot because he can. Well, because he can. And the other one would be the scene in the hangar with Jabba, where he walks over his tail.
Yeah.
And the third would be the change to the Han and Greedo sequence. Mm. And, of course, the musical number in Jabba's palace in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, it's... When you say add to the cantina scene, the first thing I thought of is that scene from Return of the Jedi, which, because I own these, I watched all the behind the scenes stuff for those, and it's at the time I'm like, oh, this is cool, and now I'm like, man, this is stupid. Why'd you do that?
Because he had the technology too, and he did not have the technology too then.
True. But had he not done all his tinkering with the special editions, we wouldn't have gotten the prequels now. Some people say, maybe we shouldn't have got the tinkering because we wouldn't have got the prequels, but then we wouldn't be where we are today. So
The prequels predate the special editions. Lucas is on record as saying that when ILM was doing the CGI for the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park in 1991-92, that he knew it was there. He knew the technology was there to do the Clone Wars, which is vital to what he wanted to do with the prequel trilogy story. So he goes and locks himself away in 97 and starts writing Phantom Menace. And You're Welcome, World.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he was thinking about coming back and doing... I mean, he talked to Hamill at one point about them doing a sequel trilogy. This is while they were on the set of Return of the Jedi. You know, it's... He always wanted to continue to play in that universe. It wasn't like, oh, let me go back and revisit this and fix this up. And then, you know, just because I want this to be my legacy. It was... This is going to be part of... Like, I have the technology to do it. This was my my creative vision was hampered by the... Constrained by the technology of the time. Let me go out and refine this film to reflect more of my artistic vision. And then let me put out my new movies that I want to continue playing in this sandbox and adding to this mythology.
Yeah, well... I don't know, it's...
Do you believe that there is still an original cut? And do you believe that it was part of the deal that was negotiated between Lucasfilm and Buena Vista Entertainment? Between Lucas and Buena Vista.
Is there an original cut somewhere?
Untouched, unedited, muddied up print of the original. Because Lucas says that he destroyed it. That he had to alter it in order to clean it up for the special editions. That he destroyed the original negative.
Like, I think if he said that, I think the original negative is gone. But is there a cleaned up, unaltered original? Probably.
That could be restored to 4K?
Probably. It just... I know George says that I think he means it in his mind. Like, you know, the special edition is now... This is it. This is what it is. But... I just can't... The way he comes off, I just can't see him, like, saying... Okay, yeah, this is... In my mind, this is what it is now. But I can't see him, like... But I parting with... An unaltered original cut, like this is the thing that made me. He might not ever show it to anybody, but I'm sure there is one. Now, does Disney have it?
We've talked about the booby trapped room.
Yeah, if I don't think Disney has it, I think George has it, and I do think it's locked away somewhere, Indiana Jones style, and he may have told Disney where it's at. And it's like, you can't have it till I'm dead. And even then, you have to go through some stuff to get it. So, yeah.
Good luck to that intern that day.
They're going to find out real quick. Then no intern is... You're going to need a little bit more than intern to get this stuff.
See, I'm of the opinion that there is probably a restored negative of the original film as it was presented in theaters in 1977. And that he took that cleaned up negative and added his stuff into it once it was inside of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so thus you get the special edition. But I think that unaltered, that cleaned up celluloid version of the originals is somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in George's mind, those are not his movies. I think in George's mind, the special editions are his movies because they're more reflective of his true creative intent and vision. I've said for years that if George Lucas had made episodes 1, 2, and 3 back in the 70s and 80s, that he would have gone back and tinkered with them and fixed them later on anyway. Because he had in his mind the way it was supposed to look and the way it was supposed to be done, but he was hamstrung by the technology of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't fully live out his creative vision. Computers allow him to fully work out his creative vision. So if computers had existed in the 70s and this kind of technology would have existed in the 70s, these are the movies we would have got.
Yeah.
And that's always been my belief. So, But the problem is, they weren't. Those editions, the computer special editions, those weren't the editions that people saw in the 70s and 80s. Those aren't the films that are cherished by that generation. And I think that Alan Horn and the people at Disney are smart enough to understand the potential home entertainment gold mine that is the original trilogy. If you put that on digital download, just fill in your number. Mm-hmm. You're going to make a whole bunch of money. Because it's not like Lucas ever stopped re-releasing the things. He re-released them like every time a format changed.
Yep. But the original, the last format is what, VHS?
Laserdisc. Laserdisc or VHS?
Can I find a Laserdisc?
Because, I mean, like, 97, VCRs, the special editions. I mean, he's never released a original cut on DVD or Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And now with 4K resolution, that would be the next step. And you hear rumors about Disney releasing a 4K edit of Star Wars, but no one ever is particularly clear on if it's that edit or if it's the special edition edit. So, I mean...
They don't say special edition anymore. It's just Star Wars.
Right. But Disney has to understand that is a potential goldmine, and George has to understand that it was a potential goldmine.
I think George knows. George just doesn't care. That's not what he wants out there.
It's not his move.
No. So, the only way it happens is if Disney does it. And the only way that happens is if George is finally like, fine, go ahead and do it. Or George goes, and there's nothing stopping Disney from doing it.
All right. So, speaking of current Star Wars, we got a whole bunch of news dump from Vanity Fair. Mm. Your thoughts on the photos, the Carrie Fisher news, which was basically, we were supposed to get three movies about the three original characters. Han in episode 7, Luke in episode 8, Leia in episode 9. And your thoughts on Johnson's details about, you know, casino planets and, you know, opulence and that kind of a thing.
Okay, so I did see the pictures. They're, you know, there's Vanity Fair, so they're well done pictures. The ones that stuck out to me were the ones with Carrie Fisher, particularly the Luke and Leia one. It's like, if you're trying to make me cry, it might actually work. So I'm just not gonna look at all this stuff, Vanity Fair. But kudos to you for that. The Carrie Fisher news. I mean, no other way around it. It's sad. It's like it sounds like they were gonna go ahead and highlight all of our old favorites of the main three, and now we won't get that because of her unfortunate passing. But it's good to know that that's the way they were going, and I would love to know what they were going to do. I'm just as curious to see how they're going to proceed now, if this was going to be so Leia focused. And if you think it's going to be that Leia focused, then it's got to be Leia with Kylo Ren. And how do they now proceed without having Leia? Or what are they going to do with the Leia character?
And they do say, in specific in the article, they do say that, you know, no script was done. So, like, when she passed, they had still... Trevorrow had not turned in a first draft of the screenplay. They had just staked out things in the story group that they were planning to do for 9.
So they're able to change things. It's just, we haven't seen 8 to know which direction they can possibly go in, to even know which direction they're going to then turn from, since she's no longer with us. Can they get away without having Leia in this movie if it was going to be so Leia-focused? So that part of it just leaves me with more questions. As far as the plot details that Johnson dropped, I kind of avoided those. So I'm really trying to go into the Star Wars movies knowing the least amount of stuff as possible. But I did see, like, the picture of the casino planet. And when I think of Casino Planet, I don't think of that picture.
You think more of, like, that was always the funniest thing to me, because in A New Hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi has that line about Mos Eisley, about it being a most wretched hive of scum and villainy. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the most wretched hive of scum and villainy. And it's like, dude, you were in a pretty raunchy place in Attack of the Clones. Like, you've been across the universe. You've seen some stuff. Some very dodgy places that were probably a lot dodgier than Mos Eisley's spaceport.
Yeah. So, when I think Casino Place, first thing, I do think of Mos Eisley. And then, this is weird, I transition to Sonic the Hedgehog 2, the video game, because there's a casino world there, and then in my mind kind of melds that place together. So it's
I always think of the place and the neon lights in Attack of the Clones.
Wait, Attack of the Clones is the second one, right?
Right.
Which is why I always space out when people say stuff about it. Because, again, I don't remember much of that movie. There was when they're in, like, the little chase thing?
Right.
Oh, that kind of fits in the...
Because my thing is, like, Johnson's description of it was, I wanted to do a place that was different from the one environment, one ecosystem planets that we've been to throughout, you know? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it's a desert planet, or it's a snow planet, or it's a forest planet. Like, he wanted to do something bright and colorful and different and opulent.
Well, looks like he's going to succeed on that end. Again, makes me wonder, why are they going to this place? And who's going to this place?
In the middle episode fashion, we split our heroes up. And I think, you know, we're going to have Rey, Chewbacca, Luke, and R2 off on one training / off on a journey. We're going to have Poe I think we're going to have Poe and Princess or General Leia and Laura Dern's character on one journey. And then I think we're in the middle of those two, we're going to have Rose and Ben together off on the journey looking for something. And Ben's going to get out of his BAFTA suit.
Okay. That sounds good. I don't know. You see more of the details, so you can say more about what I didn't see.
There's not details. This is the frustrating, like, if you give a crumb of bread to a starving man, he thinks that it is the Feast of Thanksgiving. And it's like, he's not giving us anything. He's just, if anything, he's barely confirming things that have been rumored on the internet for a while, like Laura Dern's pink hair and her character name. Like, these aren't, like, things that are going to shock your system and let you plot out the course of Episode 8. Like, it's not the new Spider-Man trailer. You know, it's a breadcrumb, and it's not Thanksgiving dinner, so let's please stop acting like it's Thanksgiving dinner.
But I mean, going from nothing to a crumb does give you something.
I got more out of the trailer in the Book of Wales and the scene of her training on R2. And, you know, the shot of Kylo Ren in the burning temple. And I got more out of that than I did from Rian Johnson saying, yeah, there's a casino planet.
No, you're right, but, you know.
Yeah, this chick has purple hair. Yeah, you know, Finn's in a BAFTA suit. You know, we advanced that technology from a BAFTA tank to a BAFTA suit.
Well, the key is to get us talking, and since we're sitting here actually right now talking about it.
There's a scene where Poe gets slapped by Leia. Yeah, you know, yeah. The R2 is the homeworld of the first Jedi Temple. Like, yeah, whatever. Like, yeah. Like, it's not like okay, here's the first official plot synopsis for the movie. It's not like, here's where we find Kylo Ren's mental mindset as he repairs himself, returns from his encounter with Rey at the end of Force Awakens. It's not, here is General Snoke, and here's how tall he actually is, and here's what his lineage is. Like, it's not gonna answer any of, does Luke have his green lightsaber still? We've had a bunch of, for example, descriptions of Luke on set, and nobody has seen him with a lightsaber on his belt. So people are actually wondering if he even still has the green lightsaber, or if it got chopped off, or if it fell off into oblivion. You know, it's not like he said, oh, by the way, I know you want to know how that blue lightsaber ended up from the Cloud City in the hands of Maz Kanata. Well, here's that story. Let me tell you, Vanity Fair, here's that story. Like, it wasn't anything like that. It was vague details that confirmed bits and pieces of information that had been floating on the internet for a year.
Well, it's May. That's kind of where we're at right now.
We still have six more weeks to go until Comic-Con. And about seven more weeks to go until, or five more weeks to go until D23. And we're not getting another trailer probably until September. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, we still at some point have to see some footage from Young Han Solo. And get an actual title for Young Han Solo beyond Young Han Solo. I mean, it wasn't like a huge Thanksgiving feast. It was a breadcrumb. And a breadcrumb that was not very satisfying.
But again, to a starving man, that is a Thanksgiving feast.
So, let's move on from our celebration of all things Star Wars. So, Chad, a very sad story happened a few years ago. The director of Top Gun, I think his name is Tony Scott, found out that he had brain cancer, and it was inoperable. And he was given 4 to 6 months to live. He left the doctor's office. He went to the LA freeway and jumped off the LA freeway and killed himself. So, at the time that he had taken his own life, there was conversations about a Top Gun 2 that was going to happen. And the idea was that the plot synopsis was going to be, you know, the age of pilots and dogfights versus the age of drone warfare. And can a pilot outmaneuver a drone? And that was going to kind of be the thing. It was on the back burner for a long while, not just because the director passed away, but also because, you know, Tom Cruise is a pretty busy individual. Yeah. Well, Tom Cruise is on the press rounds for a movie called The Mummy. And in Sydney, Australia, of all places, on a morning show, he said that Top Gun 2 is a thing, and it's actually happening, and he plans to shoot it next year. And not only does he plan to shoot it next year, he wants to work with his Oblivion guy as the director for Top Gun 2.
Yeah. So full disclosure. I didn't see Top Gun until about 2-3 years ago. So I was grown and not in the frame of mind of the 80s, like most people around my age that was young in the 80s and saw this movie and loved it. I saw it and was like, this is dumb. So, with that in mind, I don't want to see Top Gun 2. And I know there are people that are going to want to see it. I don't have a problem with them making it. I think the ship has passed.
Well, the problem that I have with the Top Gun 2 is that the perspective for me is different than the perspective for other people. Because the reading that I have of the Top Gun film is a study on grief and remorse and dealing with the consequences of your own actions. Like, his dude dies because of a mistake that he makes because he's arrogant and cocky and sure of himself, and he puts somebody else's life in danger. And then that person dies, and then he has to deal with the ramifications of that. And it's only through the love of the hot army sergeant's daughter that he reaffirms himself and goes back to flight school.
Take my breath away.
Right. And then, you know, he still gets there and he proves Val Kilmer, he earns Val Kilmer's respect, and, you know, that's it. But, like, to me, the reading of the film is a film about PTSD, about grief, about remorse, about survivor's guilt. I read the film that way, which is different from the way most people read the film, which is fly me into the danger zone. Like, most people like Top Gun for the same reason they like Days of Thunder, because it's young Tom Cruise doing high speed action stuff that looks really cool for an adrenaline junkie in a time period where, you know, those kinds of things like race car movies and fighter pilot movies weren't being done very much.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Yeah, your read is definitely different than anybody else I know that's watched the movie.
Well, and the potential read for a Top Gun 2 is interesting because it's man versus machine. Because there is a hint of that in the first movie, that computers are starting to come along, and it's like, you know, flight simulators and all of this. And it's like, well, a pilot's instinct, there's never going to be a replacement for a pilot's instinct. Well, now we have drones, which now, you know, can compensate for a lot of the things that air combat pilots can do without putting the combat pilots in danger. And so it could be the reading of that film could be very much about politics, about, you know, drone warfare, good or bad, should we be using these things? They're remote killing machines, basically. You drop a bomb in a highly civilian populated district, even though you can narrowly focus it, it's still going to have civilian casualties and collateral damage and all those arguments. And then, of course, the arguments of technology versus man. You know, so those are readings of the Top Gun 2 that could be interesting. The question is, who wants to see a Top Gun 2? And he is not the box office draw that he was in 95, 96, 97.
No, I just saw him. I can't remember the numbers, but he doesn't draw as much as you think he would in opening weekends outside of Mission Impossible. Your question is the correct one. Who wants to see a Top Gun 2? Now, with the story that's laid out, I've already seen that movie of a hotshot, arrogant, cocky fighter pilot going up against drones, and it was very good. That movie would be the Ryan Reynolds masterpiece, Green Lantern, because that's how that movie starts off. So, if you want to see Top Gun 2, just watch the beginning of that movie, because it's the same thing. I know most people didn't remember that, and I'm sorry for bringing up Green Lantern for you, but if I had to remember it, y'all all got to suffer.
I mean, it'll just be interesting to see. I mean, Cruise has the weight to get it done, so if he wants to get it done and he wants to film it, we'll see how it works 30 years on.
I don't know. I'm mildly intrigued by the premise. I just think it's too little too late.
All right. Speaking of too little too late, the McGee made his name on the Charlie's Angels franchise. Lucy Liu and Cameron Diaz and Drew Barrymore. Back in the day before, you know, these kinds of 1970s and 80s TV shows were fodder for, you know, raunchy comedies. They were, you know, actually straight action movies. So, Chad, Elizabeth Banks, she of Wet Hot American Summer fame and Zack and Mary Make a Porno fame, and the most recently, the director of Pitch Perfect 2, has been attached to a Charlie's Angels reboot. Your thoughts of the world needing a Charlie's Angels reboot?
It's a recognizable franchise, so of course reboot is gonna happen. I'm not surprised by that. I don't know how much people are going to want to see it, but I think it's worth a shot. I do like them bringing a female director for it. I wish I had seen Pitch Perfect 2 to know what Elizabeth Banks...
I mean, you didn't run into her on campus and give her some pointers?
I saw her directing a scene, but no, I didn't go over and like run up to her as much as I want to run up to her and say, I love you, and you should just come with me like right now. No, I didn't do all that, but I did see her on campus with like Rebel Wilson and the short girl that I can't remember her name right now. But I didn't see the movie, so I don't know how her directing style, what her directing style is, how it will come across. But you know, give her a chance. Why not? Charlie's Angels is not like a super mega power when it comes to franchises, so why not give her a shot?
Because the franchise hasn't had a new movie in it since like 2007.
It's been 11 years.
About a decade more by the time the movie actually gets set and filmed. Well, and it's not like Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu, and Cameron Diaz are ancient.
But you ain't touching none of that.
No, you're not. You're not. But like, I just got out of a Baywatch movie that still had Hasselhoff and Anderson in it. Granted, they were in cameos, but they were still in it. I saw a 21 Jump Street movie that had Johnny Depp in it.
True.
So
maybe you'll get a... you'll probably get a cameo for them. But
I mean, it just depends on the tone. Are you going to do like a straight action movie, which is what those McG movies are? Or are you going to go the comedy route of, you know, 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street, Baywatch, Chips?
I think you play this straight. Just because of what it is, you don't want to like... There are people that still think highly of Charlie's Angels, and
for what it was at the time.
Yeah,
I mean it's female empowerment television in a time where it was a male dominated landscape.
So you can play it. What's not to say you don't play it? Well, Elizabeth Banks tells me you won't play it this way, but like the female Jason Bourne kind of thing. I don't think they're going to go that way. Clearly with Elizabeth Banks.
No, but you could go the Agent Carter way, where you mix action and comedy.
Agent Carter's fine. I mean, those McG movies had lots of comedy. I think you play it straighter than that, but not like full-on Jason Bourne.
All right. So Disney is looking at another big-name director for one of their live-action remakes, the live-action Pinocchio. They're looking at Sam Mendes, formerly of Skyfall and Spectre. Skyfall and Spectre. Your thoughts on what he would bring to a potential live-action Pinocchio remake?
This is like the third Pinocchio idea I've heard. I only know Sam Mendes from Skyfall, so I would think it's going to be on the more serious side. Which I don't know if audiences really want a serious Pinocchio movie. When I hear that, it makes me think of him going strictly by the book. And if you know the book is... it's a little...
dark.
Yeah.
I mean, it's messed up.
Yeah, it starts off... I mean, Pinocchio like tails off Geppetto and then runs away. And he kills the cricket, like in the first two chapters. That's how this book starts. So I think he would go that way. I just don't know if people are going to be accepting of that.
I mean, we'll see. I mean, I actually like his James and the Giant Peach adaptation as a better option.
He did that one?
Well, apparently they've offered him both.
Okay.
They've offered him both the live action James and the Giant Peach remake and Pinocchio. And I've been like, James and the Giant Peach is ripe. I mean, that stop motion movie was 1998, so I mean that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, Disney just got done doing Dole with BFG last summer, not to great results, with Spielberg of all people behind the helm. Mm-hmm. So one has to wonder about the viability of Dole properties outside of Wonka, but which has forever been, you know, peed on by Johnny Depp. I mean, it's like, I've said for a while now that a lot of the more interesting takes on fairy tales especially like Disney fairy tales, have been done by Once Upon a Time on television.
This is true.
And it feels like they took more chances with more unique backgrounds on villains. Like, I know at one point in time, there was a rumor about a Emma Stone fronted Cruella de Vil movie. Yeah. The backstory that they give Cruella de Vil in Once Upon a Time is much more tragic and deep and complex and nuanced than anything I think they would ever come up with on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like they, the same thing with Ariel, the same thing with Mulan, the same thing with Pinocchio. They've done darker, more interesting, and more nuanced takes on their characters on the fairy tale side on television than they have in real life. Because if you look on the big screen, all of the sample size that we have, while it isn't very big, Peach Dragon is a beat for beat remake. It maintains the same feel and tone as the original. Cinderella maintains the same tone and feel of the original while changing some of the more fantastical elements. Jungle Book is a retelling of that animated movie, almost beat for beat. You know, Beauty and the Beast, pretty much the same aesthetic, pretty much the same setting, pretty much the same beats, same songs, a few more added in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're literally almost actual live-action recreations of animated movies. I don't think that you get Mendes if you're just going to do the When You Wish Upon a Star version of Pinocchio.
No, indeed. So, I think this will be, I guess, more adult would be a good word.
Yeah, and speaking of Once Upon a Time, they're about to, everybody is pretty much exited after this past season. They've already renewed it for another season, but they're going to do a major time jump and just move forward with pretty much a whole new cast. Jennifer Morrison and all of them have departed.
Okay. Hmm. I knew the lead was leaving. I didn't know everybody else was too.
Oh yeah, like it was like a mass, like, okay, she's done, we're all done. Okay. So that would be the interesting take, is what kind of a Pinocchio or a Dumbo movie are they looking
for? Yeah.
Yeah. So Doug Liman, very busy guy. Took on a Justice League Dark movie. Once again, exited the movie without actually doing it. It's like he injured Gambit, and walked away because the character didn't speak to him.
The spot that DC's in right now, I think they just need to walk away from Justice League Dark, much like Doug Liman did. I don't think there's an appreciation or a real want to have these characters on the movie screen. At least not now. They need to get on solid footing first, and then they can go out and start doing weird stuff. Like, Marvel didn't just come out with Guardians of the Galaxy. They built up to Avengers, and then once they had Avengers, they're like, okay, we're going to go do something weird. And it paid off for them. Justice League Dark, they haven't even got Justice League off the ground yet, and you're talking about Justice League Dark. Just let it sit on the back burner. If you want to make it, fine. But let it sit there until you get a solid foundation. Then you go out and do something weird.
I mean, like, there's going to be an animated Miles Morales Spider-Man movie, which isn't going to connect to the MCU. I mean, you could make a Justice League Dark that doesn't connect to the DCEU and just put it on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, if they want to do that, but they've already done that. They've already made an animated, basically Justice League Dark movie, and it's one of their straight to DVD stuff. If you want to leave it there, fine. But it seems like they really have it on their minds to make a live action version of this, and I just don't think now's the time for it.
No, probably not. You need to build. And as we talked about in our Wonder Woman podcast, you know, we're in a good place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're on solid footing for the first time in a while with the DCEU. And it's just a matter of how much is going to shift once we get to Justice League.
Yeah.
So, Chad, the House of Fox has a bunch of Marvel properties as well. And they have a producer. He's pretty big over there. His name is Simon Kinberg. He keeps making comments about The Dark Phoenix, which is the movie he's supposed to direct for fall 2018.
Me and this guy. He's a producer, and he keeps, you know, they keep putting the microphone in his face, so he keeps talking. Fine. But
just, nothing's off the table, Chad.
So? I don't care. I don't care. You didn't, much like DC needs to prove it with a lot of people, Fox needs to prove it to me with these X-Men movies outside of Deadpool. It looks like they're going in a very interesting way with this New Mutant stuff. I'm sure Simon Kinberg is a producer on that, but he's not talking about that. So I have faith that they can at least try this different thing they want to do and maybe make it work. But as far as the stuff he's involved with, he needs to show me that he can make more than one good movie. And right now it's only First Class. So I stop talking. If you're going to direct a movie, okay, fine. But get to that, write a good script, and then make a good movie. And until that happens, I really want to hear from you.
I mean, it's like Simon Kinberg coming out and saying that nothing's off the table as far as Dark Phoenix goes is like that scene in Dawn of Justice where Perry White looks at Clark Kent and goes, in other news, water, wet. Like, this timeline is so screwy, and this continuity is so balls-to-the-walls crazy that there's, of course, everything's on the table.
Yeah.
Of course Logan could rise from the dead and become a zombie and show up in with a zombie Jean Grey in Dark Phoenix. Like, because all of that craziness that you've done with the continuity allows for, it wouldn't surprise anybody. So, I mean, it's not news. It's just him talking about a movie that he's supposed to direct that he isn't even officially announced to direct yet.
Yeah, they need to, if he's doing it and they're trying to shoot it for next year, they need to get on that.
November 18 release date, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So they would have to
start filming by November.
At least, yeah. It sounds like they're trying to do it earlier than that. And I would think you would want to have it done earlier for a first-time director to get through all the posts. So, maybe Comic-Con is when they're shooting to officially announce all this stuff.
Alright, we'll see. Speaking of stuff they might announce at Comic-Con, there's some Deadpool 2 casting.
Yeah, I wish I remember the actor's name. But I know he was in Baywatch. But he's going to be... They basically announced this guy that may be the villain. And it sounds like the villain may be Black Tom Cassidy. I don't know how his connection to Deadpool, but he is an X-Men villain. He's actually the brother of X-Man Banshee, who we saw in X-Men First Class. And he has some sort of plant-based power. I can't exactly remember everything it does. But, yeah, he sounds like they're zeroing in on a villain. So you would think that their script is done and they're zeroing in on a start date here soon.
So, we're about a year away from Deadpool 2, and I think what we know is that, you know, Josh Brolin's going to play Cable. You know, Ryan Reynolds is going to return, as far as we know, and TJ Miller's returning as well. We don't have any cast confirmations of returning other than that, except for Blind Al. She's going to be back.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have this little bit of casting about the, we have the villain cast. And we also have Domino. We have Domino cast. We don't really know the story of Deadpool 2. We just know that there's a Deadpool 2, that these people are in it, and that's going to be a June release.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they've already had Tim Miller enter and leave, and we already know that they've been working on the script, and they asked Drew Goddard to come sit in the writer's room and help them out.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Josh Brolin signed a multi-picture deal so that we could do, you know, an X-Force movie at some point, and maybe a Cable standalone movie if he really, you know, breaks out.
Yeah. So, I don't know. They got to start doing... I forget that it's about a year, so they need to start
moving. It's a June 2018 release, because New Mutants is March, Deadpool is June, and then Dark Phoenix is supposed to be November.
Yeah, all these movies need to start rolling cameras real soon. Maybe those two, some one of them has to start by the end of the month, so we'll see what happens.
All right. Speaking of that New Mutants movie, Josh, is it Josh or Justin Boone?
Josh.
Josh Boone. I've had some problems with that on a previous podcast. Josh Boone, who directed The Fault in Our Stars, went from directing The Fault in Our Stars to getting the New Mutants gig. It's been a film that's been in development for like 4 years now. It's been shot, it's in the can, and it's in post-production. And he said it's going to have a very unique tone as they added a new member to the cast this week.
Yeah, they're going for a horror tone. I think he said it was no costumes. He said there was no costumes, something else. And then they're going for like a horror tone. And they cast, it looks like they're casting Rosario Dawson as, I think her name was Cecilia Reyes, who's a doctor from the comics. And she'll probably handle the mentor kind of role. I'm interested in it. And I think it's a nice move because, you know, as we get these comic book movies, you want to start branching out into different things to make sure everything stays fresh. So a horror take is going to be something new. I don't know how you do that with the New Mutants per se, but it's an interesting way to go. So kudos to them for that. And I don't know how they pull it off, but I'm interested to see. And adding Rosario Dawson is good because, you know, she's great. Love her.
So Chad, you know what the last Fox Marvel film to use the term horror in relation to its tone and setting was?
Fantastic Four.
Was talking about being a body horror movie.
Yeah.
And pretty much the strongest scene of the entire movie is the transformation scene, which is very body horror-rific.
Yeah.
But other than that, the movie bears no tone. No difference. You know, does not resemble that tone at all.
Yeah, it's... Well... Hopefully.
Is this going to be like Kevin Feige and the Russos going around chatting from the mountaintops that, you know, Winter Soldier is like a 70s political thriller, when like the closest thing that it ties to as a 70s political thriller is it has, you know, Robert Redford in it?
No, because if you say it's going to be horror elements, I think you've got to get closer to that. I just don't know what that means in a movie that, well, I was going to presume that's PG-13, but it's Fox and, you know, they venture to R, so I don't know what that really means now.
So, the New Mutants are training at the X-Mansion and the power goes out and a killer starts going from room to room hunting the New Mutants? And they start all using their powers to try and stop him?
I guess, but you can't really kill them. I doubt you kill any of them, so... Yeah, I don't really know what that means. Maybe somebody captures them and puts them, like, Saw style in some warehouse and they have to get their way out or something. I don't know.
It would definitely be an interesting take, and that's, I think, a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
So, Chad, continuing on with our Fox Marvel news, because they dropped a lot of it this week. Mangold, on the press tour for the Blu-ray for Logan, says that if there is an X-23... future down the line, it will be a movie and it will be done by him and it will be a solo movie. Your thoughts? Because last time we see X-23, spoilers for Logan, running off into the Vancouver woods. Because, you know, Canada's now a safe haven for
mutants, yeah. I don't know what that means, because if we have this movie, you would think it means we're in that future, which isolates her from everything else. Which they could do, but it seems like they would want to make her like in the same vein as Wolverine. And I know Wolverine's had three movies of his own, but he works well together with the rest of the X-Men. which you can't really have unless you're like establishing a new team of X-Men in Canada in this far off future, not so far off future, which they could do. I think it's dumb, but they could do it.
Because they were all kids, but they still need a mentor of some kind.
Yeah,
and they were all just band together trying to traverse the forest.
Yeah, but it's just I don't know. I think she needs to be with a team of X-Men that they're gonna come up with, either New Mutants or this.
She couldn't band together with those other mutants and create a new X-Men in this holy land of Canada.
They could, but it's gonna be a whole bunch of people we don't know, and are we gonna care about them?
Well, that's why you get creative new mutants. Literally, new mutants. You get creative young kids. We didn't see all the abilities of all those kids.
True.
So you can create whole new mutants, whole new skill sets that don't come from the comics.
Yeah. Yeah, you could. I don't know how the audience is going to take it. But they seem to really like her, so maybe that's the way to go. If that's the only way they can.
Studio wanted to make her a teenager. He wanted her to be a preteen.
Which is smart because she can grow into the role now. But I mean, if that's the best way they feel they can get her back on the screen is through making up these new mutants, go for it, I guess.
I mean, it's just going to be interesting. I think Mangold needs a palate cleanser after this. I mean, from the Wolverine and, you know, Logan back to back. But if he decides to return to this universe, I don't think Fox will say no.
No.
And I think it would be very interesting to see what he could come up with, especially considering the kind of tone and the reality that he set with Logan.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the character. I'm just iffy on how they progress it from here.
So also on that Blu-ray press tour, he was saying that Jean Grey was an hallucination of Jean Grey was once a part of the dinner scene. Your thoughts? Because she's in the Wolverine. He has that dream about her, which definitely sets it in. This is after the events of X3. Apparently before the events of Days of Future Past.
I'm rolling my eyes so hard right now, because I think cutting her from a movie was a good call.
But they're intertwined. Like, their story and her death, which is caused by him in X3, which they have never denied, has been a huge part of him and his issues as he's gone forward. Like, their relationship, their dynamic has been a core part of Logan's story from the beginning. From the first time he sees her at the X-Mansion.
You're right. I'm just tired of it. Because after X2, I haven't liked anything they've done with it. I just want it to go away.
I think in better hands, that story could have been utilized better in X3. If you were still going to go the route of having him be the one to execute her. And I like what they did in The Wolverine. Because it shows he has PTSD. About killing the woman that he loves.
Okay, I like that part. I'll give you that. I guess their thought to have Wolverine be the one to kill her, and because he's the one that's in love with her. I just hate it from jump because he can be in love with her, but it should never be in the, like, that makes it kind of, even though he's never with her, the fact that she wants him to kill her and he wants to kill her.
And Cyclops is just standing on the sidelines.
Oh no, this time he's vaporized. That just makes it seem like a requited love, even though they never get together, and it should never be. It really should be, he loves her, she likes infatuation, but she's never going to leave Cyclops, because she knows Cyclops is the better one for her. And in this one, they just completely ignore all that, so I just hate the whole dynamic of it.
But, under the rules that they set up, it's a very compelling narrative for his story.
It is, but I don't care.
I mean, I think it was the right thing to cut it from the movie, unless you did, like I said, another dream sequence.
Yeah. But no. No, it was the right thing to do to cut it.
I mean, I'm okay with cutting that. I also am a big fan of the fact that they don't show the destruction of the kids. Like, they don't show Charles losing his mind at the X-Mansion and killing all the old X-Men. They just say it on the radio.
Yeah.
I thought that was really clever exposition that you just... to get a big story point out there that comic book fans are going to pick up on, but it's not necessarily inherent to understanding the story as a whole.
Yeah.
Just, you know, kind of like the whole, you know, all mutants have been hunted down and killed. You know, it's kind of like he's seen his friends die. Which is part of the problem of being immortal.
True.
So. All right. So that about does it for Fox Marvel news. Sony made some Spider-Man news this week. Their Spider-Man universe of their own, which includes a Tom Hardy-led Venom movie, is now going to have a Black Cat / Silver Sable movie directed by a young female, up-and-coming female director that was named this week. Your thoughts on Sony taking further steps to... ensure that there is a cinematic universe beyond the Marvel Cinematic Universe for them.
So, okay, so her name is Gina Prince-Bythewood, and she, what else has she done? She, dang it, I can't find it. Oh, she wrote Love and Basketball, and she directed The Secret Life of Bees. So on one hand, I'm really happy that they've gone and got a female director to do
this, an American female director.
Yes, to do this movie. I think it's the right move to try to if you want to go this route with this movie. However, I still don't think they should do this movie. Period, because it's reaching further and further into the hand of Spider-Man. And
God bless Avi Arad.
Yeah. And you don't want to keep hamstringing Spider-Man from Marvel. That's really where your money's going to be made. So I understand that they want to, you know, they want to have their own dip of the Spider money by themselves.
Dude, this looks increasingly to me like as if they're putting together a universe that Holland can come play in after Homecoming 2 is done. Like, they're setting things up because they have a bajillion Spider-Man characters that they own the rights to. And, like, they want to have this set up so that if... You know, I'm still, like, trying to wrap my mind around the fact that Tom Hardy, A, wants to play Eddie Brock, and B... that they're going to do a Venom movie with no Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Unless they just do a CGI Spider-Man who never takes off his mask and is voiced by Tom Holland.
But that defeats the purpose. So I think that you're right, but I think it's the wrong play.
It's the wrong play to make before you see what the box office receives.
Exactly. I think if Homecoming is a hit like everybody thinks it will be, Sony will come back to this and revisit and be like, maybe we don't want to do these things just this way. Maybe they still do at least this one. Like, I think they could do this one. This one you can separate enough, but still be like, you know what? Marvel, can we just, like, include it in that too? And I think that could work, but just... stay out of the Spider-Man bag. Let Marvel do it. See what happens, and then go from there. You'll be better off with it than with Marvel right now than without them. Because I think if you set this up to take Spider-Man back after Homecoming 2, there's a potential for the fans to turn on it, and you're like, done. So, if I'm Sony,
Because if you put yourself in a situation where the two Homecoming movies are well received and Spider-Man's done really well, bouncing off the other Avengers in 3 and 4. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, we've made good money. I mean, we may have even made $1 billion, but you know what? We want to take our ball and go back home.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Like, you're not going to end all the goodwill that you've just engendered just...
Down the drain. Oh, it's... I don't know.
Not to mention the fact that Tom Hardy's an older dude. So, like, it's not like you're going to have him playing Venom for, like, 10 years.
Yeah. It's only a few movies. It's,
I don't know. I like the casting choice. Like, all the choices around it, I like. It's just the initial
There's
choice.
A guy overseeing it that doesn't build, imply any kind of confidence.
Yeah, no. No. But we'll see. I hope this doesn't happen.
So, they also released a couple of new Spider-Man trailers this week. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on those, as I have now officially entered spoiler-free territory, where I'm trying to avoid all TV advertisements and or trailers.
So the first trailer, the domestic trailer, is not as spoiler filled. It does have a few new things, but it doesn't really advance the story for you so much. The international trailer, I think, while it doesn't give anything away, I think it makes it easier to plot out what happens where in the movie. It was fun seeing all the new stuff, but if you don't want to know anything, you avoid the international trailer. But they're really trying to bring home the fact that, you know, Spider-Man is in the Marvel Universe. And I think they have to do it because...
Well, dude, he's walking around Avengers Tower talking to Tony Stark. I mean...
But I still hear stories every day about people that are like, another Spider-Man movie, I don't know if I want to go see it. Because those people have no idea that is in the Marvel Universe. So... Everybody that's going to watch these trailers and these TV spots from now on, you're going to see Iron Man and Avengers Tower all over it. And that's just to hammer home the point that Spider-Man's with Marvel Studios. I think Iron Man's, he plays a big part in the movie, but I don't know if he's going to be in there as much as all this is letting him see, as it's going to seem.
You mean, so you're thinking they're going to have to put more than just the one shot of Iron Man flying next to Spider-Man as he swings?
I think you get that shot, and I think you get him saving the barge and him with in the car, and they're one other scene in Avengers Tower. And I think that's it. I think those are his four scenes. But they're going to plaster those four scenes everywhere until the movie comes out.
There should not be a bad strategy.
No. Like I said before we started, since Iron Man 2, every movie with Iron Man in it has made $1 billion. So, yeah, that's what they're going to do.
I mean, it's I'm hopeful. I mean, it's really a big step forward. And, you know, if out of the 16 films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it finishes in the top five, that'll be really good money for them. Right. So.
Yeah. And I think that's what they're hoping for.
Well, I mean, the question's got to be, where are Sony's expectations? Take MCU out of it, like ranking it among the 16, at that point, the 16 films in the MCU. Like, I find it kind of hard to believe where the projections are now that if this Spider-Man movie finishes just $150 million above the two Amazing Spider-Man movies domestically, mm-hmm. and behind the three Raimi movies domestically, both in terms of opening weekend and final box office tally domestically. Because remember, you still have both Dunkirk and War for the Planet of the Apes coming after it. Mm-hmm. That they're going to be ecstatic about that. About basically handing the reins over to Marvel and only seeing about $150 million bump out of it.
Yeah. I think they want to make more money than that. But
if because like the those two movies, Amazing Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man 2, made around $750 million. $750, $750, somewhere around there.
They both were in the sevens. Right. I know that, yeah. They want to make more money than that. But I think if the reception is overwhelmingly positive, I think that will kind of balance it out.
Civil War, like,
yeah.
Spider-Man Civil War type price.
Yeah. And I think that'll even it out. But then the next one has to make like $1 billion.
Alrighty. So, speaking of the guy who plays Spider-Man and the Sony property, Sony has announced that Tom Holland has signed on to play Nathan Drake in Uncharted, which is a severe departure from the rumors we've heard about the Uncharted movie for about the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we've gone from guys like McConaughey and Pratt and Bradley Cooper... And at one point back in the day, Noah Wiley, to, you know, this young kid.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting take on a guy who is essentially Indiana Jones.
So, being a Tom Holland fan, I think it's good to have him as young Nathan Drake. I just don't know. I haven't played Uncharted, so I don't really have an opinion about it one way or another. But I think the fans are going to be disappointed that it's only young Nathan Drake. Even though I think they will all be ecstatic that it's Tom Holland being
it's a longer Drake. It's a longer play. I mean, if you go get McConaughey and pay him a whole bunch of money, you'll be lucky to get three movies out of it.
True. But you can't tell the fans that they want, you know, satisfaction now. And not, oh, this kid's going to grow into what you're expecting.
And the crazy thing is, those people would be over the moon ecstatic about a young Indiana Jones movie right now.
Well, yeah, they would. They would. So,
it would be a way for their franchise to live on for years after their star is dead.
But the difference is, we've seen Indiana Jones on screen before. They haven't seen Nathan Drake on screen before. So I get their gripe, but, you know,
didn't hear these same people complaining when Lara Croft Tomb Raider was being made by Angelina Jolie, who was like one of the hottest stars in the world at the time.
I think everybody was kind of just okay with that. I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
But it's just because Tom Holland, even though he's like 21, he looks like he's 16.
Yeah.
So I think that's a part of it too.
And again, the young part of the young Nathan Drake story and where that fits into the canon that the video games have introduced and how he learns, as you said, to grow into that guy.
Yeah.
I think they want something a little bit further down the line in terms of development.
Mm-hmm. I agree. But, I mean, the kid is good, and I think people are going to like him in the role. So they just have to get over that initial shock first, and then I think they'll be fine.
All right. So, Chad, there was a very popular Resident Evil franchise that just passed away. Finally released its sixth installment this past year, and is it Mia Kulis? What's her name? Maya. Maya Djokovic.
Mila Djokovic,
who has embodied that character wholeheartedly for about a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
They finally wrapped production and got that movie out this year to okay numbers comparison with all the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're already talking about the reboot.
Well, it's because it became like this action-adventure franchise.
The most financially successful video game franchise in history.
True, but most video game, the fans of the video game are like, that's not the video game. So this reboot, particularly that James Wan is attached to produce, when you hear James Wan and Resident Evil, you're like, oh, so they're going to go back to the horror
roots. You hear James Wan and you hear Mortal Kombat and you get excited too. And we're nowhere closer to moving forward on that.
True. It really is because of the horror elements that James Wan brings that people are going to be excited about this. Yeah, you're right. We might not see this for a long time. But just his name attached to it gives it some life. I mean, I think they should wait a little while before it actually do the reboot. But having him on to produce, it's a good move.
Yeah, brand name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, what was it, Anderson?
Wes Anderson?
Yeah, that was attached to all these movies.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's also married to Mila Jovovich, so.
Right, but, I mean, like, that's a name.
But, yeah, it's just the way the series turned out.
Yeah, because it increasingly got, it's like Underworld, it got increasingly close to like direct to DVD territory.
Yes. And I think people just want the horror element in Resident Evil, not so much the hey, bang, shoot 'em up, blow up stuff.
Well, it's kind of the whole deal.
You can mix the action adventure with some more of the horror elements. I think that's their biggest gripe.
I mean, we'll see. Like I said, Juan's also on tap to produce a Mortal Kombat movie that may or may not ever see the light of day. So.
Yeah.
And then there's also the fact that, you know, Steven Spielberg's a producer on the Transformers movies. Exactly how much input that dude have on Transformers.
Hit a cup of coffee with Michael Bay in the first one, and that's been it.
Yeah.
And he's been a producer ever since.
So, I mean, the only time he really stepped into assert his authority was after the second one, where he was like, nope. We're done with Megan Fox. Have a nice day.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think James Wan will be more hands-on in that, but We'll see. I don't think
of the two, I would be more interested to see a Mortal Kombat movie than a Resident Evil movie. If you're talking video games, you're talking video game movie adaptations. I know Mortal Kombat has already had its movie adaptation back in 95, but there are some interesting takes and some interesting spec scripts out there that could, I think, lend themselves to really good Mortal Kombat movies.
Yeah, I agree.
So, and like I said, I've just gotten done seeing 6 Resident Evil movies, and unless you're going to repackage it severely, I don't really know how you get the pop culture awareness of the general movie going public behind that.
Yeah.
So, we have a pair of animated movies that got sequel announcements this week. Your thoughts, sir, on the fact that Boss Baby, which has been surprisingly financially successful for DreamWorks Animation, has got its sequel under their new deal with Universal, and Angry Birds is a go 2 is a go over at Sony.
I'm not surprised by either. I think they both made some money. Boss Baby has been really...
Boss Baby has been, you know, like, it was in the top 2 or 3 for the entire length of the marked run that it had.
Yeah.
For a movie to stay in the top 5 of the box office for a month, and it's an animated kids movie...
That's insane. I saw the movie. It's okay. But I didn't think it was, like, going to stay in the top 5 the whole freaking month. Kind of good.
Well, I mean, it was better than Peabody and Sherman. It was better than The Croods. It was better than Home. So, I mean, it was, just, like, at least a quasi step up in what they've been doing lately. I mean, they're kind of a mess over there.
True.
And they've now fallen under the Universal banner, which is kind of looking at them as a secondary animation output studio because they own Illumination.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, but
by the way, speaking of Illumination, this is your friendly reminder that there is a Despicable Me 3 coming this summer, and a Minion sequel also coming.
I didn't know about the Minion sequel. I know about Despicable Me 3. I expect that movie to do well. Even though I do keep forgetting that
it's coming. A $1 billion franchise. It's close to a $1 billion franchise.
I know. And people don't remember that Minion. I don't think Minions got there, but it was still like...
It got close. Yeah.
I didn't remember if it got close or it just stayed in the 9s. But I know it was very close. I don't know if this one's going to do it because people didn't like the Minions so much. But, you know. As far as...
The Minions... Here's the thing about the Minions. As cute and as adorable as they are, the problem with the Minions movie is that there's too many humans. Like, there's too many humans. The jokes work, but, like, for me, if you were gonna do a Minions movie, instead of doing a search for a new supreme leader to serve, you could have done one of the others that were in the short. You could have put them with Dracula. That would have been fun to see the Minions serving Dracula back in the day, or to see the Minions serving Napoleon. That would have been funny. You know, that would have been more interesting to me than, you know, a giant tall Stan walking around London.
True. I saw Minions, but I fell asleep on it, so I don't really remember.
And then, of course, their own more recent movie is Secret Life of Pets, which is basically Toy Story with dogs.
Yes, it is. And I've seen that one, and that was...
It's Toy Story with dogs.
It really is. I have no argument with you. You were absolutely positively correct.
Like, Baywatch is like 21 Jump Street beat for beat. Like, Secret Life of Pets is Toy Story, pretty much beat for beat, except exchange out toys for dogs. Dogs,
yeah. Oh, but we got way over here. I'll to come back to Boss Baby. I'm surprised they hadn't announced Boss Baby too earlier than this.
Well, maybe they were trying to negotiate with Baldwin to make sure that he comes back.
Because
he's already in the press release, they already announced that he's coming back. So
it's my thing with the announcement was that I think it's not until 2020.
Yeah, 2021.
2021. That's just too far. Like, I took my kid to see Boss Baby this year. She's 8. 2021, she's going to be 11. She's not going to want to go see it. Now, she's 9 going on 10. And you say, Boss Baby 2, she's going to be more inclined to want to go see it. 11, you're probably going to be pushing it. So I thought they would have wanted to strike while this iron is like red hot instead of like meander and just get to the date. But that's, you know, that's their choice. And Angry Birds, I don't really have much else to say besides, you know, they made money. It's a known property. Of course, they're going to make a sequel.
But that was, again, a point in time where if they'd have made the movie like 2 years earlier, they would have made more money.
Oh, yeah. They had made it 2-3 years earlier.
Yeah, they dragged their feet way too long.
Yeah, we could have been on Angry Birds 2 right now, and it would have probably made more money than this first one did. But it made money, and it's probably not all that expensive to make, so, you know, it's whatever. They were going to do it anyway.
So, Chad, we covered on our Wonder Woman podcast the story of the transition that's taking place at the top of the Justice League movie. I think at this time it would be appropriate for us to extend our heartfelt condolences to the Snyder family on their loss, and to once again offer our support to Snyder as a human being and as a artist who sacrifices much to produce the art that we all criticize and belittle. Your thoughts on the transition from Joss Whedon, from Zack Snyder to Joss Whedon? How much influence he's going to have over those reshoots, what those reshoots are going to entail, and what that means for the finished product that's coming out in 5 months.
Okay, so on our Wonder Woman podcast, we didn't touch on the actual movie part of it as much because, you know, it was still fresh about what happened with Zach and their daughter.
Yeah, a dude had to come out and publicly confirm a personal family tragedy so that the internet would not think that he got fired.
Right. And it's a shame we had to do it, that. We have to say these things, like, to acknowledge that he's a human being, first and foremost. But, you know, it's a terrible thing. It's still, like, really a sensitive subject. But since we touched more on the human side of it this time, and if you want to hear the human side, you can go listen to the Wonder Woman podcast. Go ahead, click that link now. I'll go talk about the movie aspect of it. So Joss was apparently brought on before Zach left to work on some scenes that were going to be
reshot. Yeah, how long ago was the official announcement of him doing Batgirl? Was that like a month ago?
It seems like it was in March or early April. So yeah, about a month. He's going to have full control over the reshoots that are going to happen here soon, whenever they get everybody
together. Mid-July, right around Comic-Con time,
yeah, probably. And these are reshoots that were scheduled ahead of time.
And every major blockbuster does. The original Avengers movie underwent reshoots.
Yes, every one of them does it, so this is nothing new.
This is not like... I still will not understand how things got so crazy on the Rogue One reshoots, but like this is not like they're reshooting the entire movie. They're fixing some scenes, as Charles Robin said. This is the course that Zach's plotted for us. He's just passing the baton over to Joss to finish the race.
Yeah. So with that said, I don't expect this to be a Joss Whedon movie. No, he's just finishing the movie for Zack Snyder. I do think that you will feel his influence, particularly with those new scenes and how those new scenes play with old ones. Hopefully they mesh well together. I'm just intrigued by how this whole little thing is going to work, because it's one guy that's clearly got one style finishing a move for this other guy who's clearly got another style, but he's keeping that other guy's style, yet he's cleaning up some things that were already agreed upon.
He's adding some humor.
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing. There are already some rumors about... there have been rumors about the Justice League reshoots for like the past couple of weeks. And there's another one today where people have disputed them having reshoots because they haven't had them yet. But there's another rumor that they were reshooting while they were actually shooting.
Like, Rovan had already come out and said, the reason we haven't done reshoots yet is because of this situation with Zach, and we were figuring out the transition. He tried to work through it. He couldn't work through it. So now we're going to pass the baton on to Josh to finish it up and still make the... Like, the fascinating part of the story that got overlooked by everybody was the fact that Snyder said, Warner's asked me if I wanted to move the release date.
Yeah.
Like, they were going to move a major Hollywood tentpole movie that is worth $1 billion to help accommodate Zach.
Yes. That you can't understate how huge that is. Again, this is like, this is the movie they had. Wonder Woman, you know, they needed to do well, but this is the movie that they have to land. And they're like, no, your family is more important. If you want to finish it, we will hold the movie. We will push it back for you to come back and finish it. And but Zach was like, no, we need to get this movie out. So this is the resolution they came up with. It's so unprecedented. It's just going to be fascinating to see how it all plays out.
Yeah. I mean, the closest thing I can think of is like, you know, a guy filming a movie, directing a movie, and then dying on set. And then them shutting down production for a couple of weeks, and then somebody else coming in to finish the movie.
Yeah, it's...
Or in the case of Orson Welles, dying while filming a movie, and someone coming in 30 years later and finishing it up.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting to see. And it'll also be interesting to see how much leeway the fans are going to give this movie now that they know that Joss had a hand in it. And they seem more amenable to his style as opposed to Zach.
There's a background of success.
Yes. So maybe that'll soften up some of the Stone Cold, in quotation marks, DC haters.
Well, it's not like Joss has to do this for an audition to get a DC movie.
No, he's already won all of his comic book auditions.
Right. I mean, between Buffy and Angel, and then, of course, the Avengers.
Yeah. Just like, let's not forget, yeah, this is the TV guy that took over Avengers, so, and he made it the biggest comic book movie of all time. He's won his auditions. It's over.
Yeah, and he made his money on Age of Ultron.
Yeah, and took his break, and now he's back to do more. After hearing the stories about him being so, beaten down from Age of Ultron, I never thought he'd take comic book movies again.
Well, again, I think that both sides suffer from that, from the weight of expectations of Age of Ultron, because you're following up the third highest grossing movie of all time.
Yeah.
And you're in part of the cinematic landscape where you're part of a cinematic universe that you helped establish, and now you've got, you know, you want to tell the story of Ultron, but you're also having to weigh these other 15 things that you have to do and how much you want to set up in Marvel, even as late as Age of Ultron, still trying to figure out their balance of setup for future stuff along with standalone movie. And, you know, they went back and forth. The thing that I will say and will defend forever, because even Joss has said it, this wasn't Feige, this was the creative committee, and we all know now that the creative committee has been disbanded.
Yeah.
Perlmutter's been moved from movies to TV. Feige's in charge of all things movies, and he reports directly to Alan Horn. So, I mean, like, these kinds of issues that we kept hearing about with guys like Edgar Wright, guys like Alan Taylor, guys like Joss Whedon, I don't think we're going to hear those going forward with people like James Gunn, people like Scott Derrickson, people like Waititi, people like John Watts. I think it's going to be a more creatively free place going forward.
Yeah.
Because to be quite honest, if you look at if you look at Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, if you look at Guardians, period, they feel like standalone movies that have very little to do with anything else in the cinematic landscape.
Yep.
Doctor Strange kind of feels like a standalone movie. It doesn't feel like it's trying to set up anything going forward 15 steps down the road. True. It feels like his story.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think we're going to get to a place now with the transition and the creative habits of Marvel that, you know, these kind of oppressive filmmaker situations are going to be less and less.
Yeah, I agree.
So, but yes, most of the time, guys like that walk away from big budget temples and they go and do a small palate cleanser. For goodness sakes, George Miller's been talking about going away and doing a small palate cleanser and then coming back and doing more Mad Max. Dude, you're like 80. If you're going to go do another palate cleanser, go do it and do it like soon so that we can get on to this because we all want this.
Yeah.
But Josh didn't really do anything. You know, he directed a few episodes of TV, helped his brother out with some of the Avengers stuff, and that's pretty much been it.
Yeah.
He hasn't even, like, gone to his backyard and filmed a Shakespeare movie the way he did in between Avengers and Age of Ultron.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, I think that Batgirl is in good hands, and I think this will be a good stabilizing force in the DC creative for Justice League. It will endure some goodwill for the project, not only because of Joss, but because of the situation, and I think there'll be less hate on the project as a result of it. And as we said on the Wonder Woman podcast, I think it's just Snyder wanted the movie out there because he wanted to be done with it, and he wants to be done with DC comic book movies, and he wants to move on to new creative endeavors. And I think clearly the fan base is ready for him to move on in a different creative direction. So, I mean, I think it's good for both parties that this is just out there and done.
Yep. Very much so.
And we can move onward and upward.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. All right, so that'll about do it on this week's podcast. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter at BCW Tiger Fan.
And at The Mystery.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.